Look, up on the slopes. What is that? Well, it looks like a pair of cross-country skiers going downhill. No, it must be some alpine skiers with broken bindings. Wait, on closer inspection, it's...
Those Telly Guys.
Hello and welcome to Those Telly Guys. My name is Rich, and unfortunately, in this week's episode, I'm not joined by my co-host, Morgs. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the planets to align. Although we were skiing together recently, we forgot to do the intro and outro to this. So it's just me here today, but we've got a very exciting episode because we're catching up with one of my, I guess, idols, if you like, in terms of skiing and tying that with education about climate change, Greg Hill. And for those that don't know, Greg's done some really cool films about lowering your carbon emissions to hopefully in the future protect our winters. So Greg's not just a pro skier, filmmaker, or ski guide. He is the embodiment of the very spirit of adventure that draws us to the mountains. And he's done some really cool things, including some first ascents, breaking world records and making world records, and has obviously a relentless drive to push the limits of what the human body is able to do. So please fasten your seatbelts, because we're about to take a deep dive into the world of ski mountaineering, breaking world records, and a commitment to preserving our precious winter wonderlands all across the world. So sit back and relax as I have a chat with the one and only Greg Hill. All right. In today's episode, we have a truly interesting guest that I've been following for a long time. He's a pro skier, filmmaker, ski guide, and an advocate for sustainable adventure. His journey in the world of skiing has been nothing short of legendary, from setting world records for climbing and skiing to his remarkable feats in the mountains. What really sets our guest apart is having an unwavering commitment to leaving the planet in a better shape for future generations, fueled not by recognition and fame, but a deep fortitude and respect for the environment. He challenges himself to adventure in a more sustainable and responsible fashion by pushing the limits of himself and technology, inspiring others whilst raising awareness of the challenge we all face together. Greg Hill, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thank you. It's always weird when you hear what people say about you. When I was looking at the, actually, honestly, when you said unwavering, and it's, I wish I was unwavering. It's a challenge at times to always be positive and standing up for the environment. And I definitely waver a bit, but I stay true to it though.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure we'll touch on some of those challenges later, but yeah, you have been someone I've been watching closely, and I used to be a former outdoor educator myself. I'm currently working for the National Park Service down here in Victoria. So I used to show some of your videos to my students to deliver a certain message about climate change, and it really resonated with them well. And again, we'll probably touch on those things later on, but I am particularly interested in getting you on the show because if there is going to be substantial change in the future, which it looks like there's definitely evidence to that's happening, our mountains will definitely feel the effects of those first.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a scary thing. I was just hanging out at a glacier the other day and just watching it melt. And I've often said, if glaciers screamed when they melted, maybe we'd do more, but you just stand by them and you watch them drip, drip, drip. And it's so insistent and continuous that you can just see that it's going to be a hard one to stop and then ideally reverse.
Yeah. I think we all know what the solution is, but those things are probably pretty hard for everyone to kind of get used to, I suppose, and make the changes. But it's probably apt to start somewhere, and it's hard to know where to start, really, Greg, because you've accomplished so many things on a pair of skis as an athlete and a filmmaker and a guide. So where did your passion for skiing and adventure begin?
I grew up in Quebec, south of Montreal, in basically countryside. So I spent a lot of time in the deciduous forest and hiking around the little old hills, the Appalachian Mountains. And I definitely, our nearest neighbor was 2 kilometers away. You know, it was definitely in the middle of nowhere, and that's definitely where most of my appreciation for nature started, just because I was always in it. And the skiing, I mean, in Quebec, there's all these little ski resorts that are quite incredible. And I was fortunate enough that Sutton, the town I lived in, had its own little mountain, and I ended up skiing there a lot. And it was just kind of the first taste of freedom and just fun when your parents would drop you off for the whole entire Saturday and then Sunday, and you just go and ski with your buds or ski race or what have you. And yeah, it was just a really fun time as a kid. And I have to attribute the fact that my parents, we had a 20 centimeter sort of rule, and if it snowed that much, we'd go to the ski hill. And I had quite a few days where I was skiing with my mom or my dad and have these epic ski days. And I think part of me is kind of stuck on that feeling of skipping school, and that when I'm skiing, I'm skipping school. So I'm trying to skip school for as long as I can.
Wow. Yeah, well, the 20-centimeter rule, if it snows 1 centimeter here, everyone's on the mountain. I can tell you that right now. Don't have the luxury of picking. Yeah, cool. Yeah. So I guess in those early days, when you're in your formative years, I guess you definitely made a decision to make a career out of skiing. But I guess before getting to that decision point, what were some of the types of skiing you were interested in as a young man?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I growing up out east, it was just kind of, I did a bunch of racing because it was a way to go ski a couple of days a week at my high school and get kind of 3 days of skiing every week because I definitely loved skiing right away. Sorry, I just kept up.
Yeah,
okay. But no, so most of my skiing was done in Quebec on those mountains, and it was really fun. But kind of when I became a climber, a rock climber around 16, and did a ton of rock climbing, it kind of exposed me to adventure and just this, like, there's this world of possibility out there. And the rock climbing was like my gateway. And it brought me out west to, after I pulled out of university and realized I needed to go wander for a while. The rock climbing pulled me out, and I moved into Canmore, and I was ice climbing that winter because I wanted to learn mountain skills. Because if you want to become a mountain climber and you're going to climb ice, you got to climb rock and everything. And that winter I did a bit of, I worked at a ski resort, Sunshine Village in Banff, and that kind of hooked me onto skiing. And then they just opened this backcountry zone, Delirium Dive. And we always helped them open it up. So I had this kind of epic year of skiing, even though I was there to ice climb. And then the next year my shoulder dislocated, and I was started dislocating quite a bit. And all of a sudden I couldn't really climb much because you can't climb without an arm. And I quickly just kind of luckily shifted my focus into backcountry skiing because I realized I had a ton of the same kind of challenges and rewards and excitement. And I was like, I can't climb, but oh, I can do this. And that's kind of how I got into the mountains, really.
I mean, what a great place to get into backcountry skiing. Just out of Canmore there. I visited it many years ago, but it was definitely seems like a bit of a mecca for the sport.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea. And it was great that there was a ski patrol that kind of taught me a few things that year and just gave me a bit of like knowledge to temper my enthusiasm for a little bit because I was definitely really excited.
Yeah.
But yeah, after that year in Canmore, I moved to Whistler because everyone knows Whistler's pretty awesome. Lived with 12 Aussies in a house. It was awesome.
Oh, okay. It was good. No, I was going to apologize, but that's
no, good. No, it was chaos, but I was whatever I was 22 and 23 and it was great. But that's where I kind of got into the backcountry skiing. Whistler's got a ton of open, easy access to the backcountry there. And I just started realizing that I had a ton of energy and fitness from tree planting that I did every summer to make money. And I just could go and start hiking up and down mountains. And it was kind of every mountain I got on, I look further and go, God, I wonder if I can get there one day or ski that. And it just, yeah, it's infinite possibilities of adventure out there.
I did read somewhere that you kind of learned how to develop your endurance tree planting. Is there any truth to that?
Oh, it's huge truth. Yeah. Now that there's a lot of this research on zone 2 exercise and how that's really just kind of the zone you need to train most of your time. And tree planting was kind of like that. It was like a job where you got dropped off at 7 and you worked till 5, like a 10-hour day. And it was basically an endurance day. You'd get paid per tree and you had to walk and carry and climb and plant all these trees in this logged area. And so I'd do 10 hours of endurance day after day all summer in that kind of, you know, pushing but still able to talk zone 2, and then just spent that all day for the entire summer. And it was year after year of doing that where I kind of developed this incredible work ethic, because any second you stopped working you weren't making money. And took that same ethics to ski touring, where it's just like, keep moving, you know, always be in motion. Yeah, it definitely was what taught me how to ski tour millions of feet.
Yeah, very interesting. I'll have to look into this zone 2 training and maybe get into some tree planting for the next season. But at some point, you decided to make a career out of skiing, I guess. What were some of your original goals and ambitions?
Yeah, honestly, at first, I was just trying to, I wanted to learn. Because I had all this energy and I wanted to do all these things, and I needed to take courses to make sure I didn't kill myself. Like my first avalanche course in 99, well, it's my second one. I did it like a 2-dayer, but this was like a week long avalanche course in 1999. We were digging pits on the side of this mountain, and all of a sudden our instructor yelled avalanche, and we looked up and the entire mountainside was coming down towards us.
Jeez.
Anyhow, what happened is there was a group of 5, triggered it. Two of them were my buddies. One of them died. I didn't know that at the time, but I found out afterwards while we were part of the rescue. And so there was my first avalanche course, showed me the harsh reality of adventure, and the other side of all the excitement is that side, and really made me realize if I want to keep doing things, I need to learn as much as I could. So I took a guides course that same winter, and then I got into another guide stream to learn as much as I could and just kind of find mentors and develop my own mountain sense, but learn from as many different super experienced people as possible. But yeah, I actually never thought about becoming a pro skier. I'd never dreamed about it. I just never thought that was a reality for me. When I lived with those Aussies in Whistler, if we had a good day, we used to come back. And if it was a sick day, you'd be like, sponsors are happy. Just as like a joke, as if we were sponsored. And then, yeah, once I started taking my work ethic from tree planting into ski touring, and a lot of wild things hadn't been done endurance wise, I won a few ski mountaineering races or randonnée races. That's when sort of Arc'teryx kind of saw me and we were like, hey, want to start wearing our stuff? And it kind of just slowly grew from there. But yeah, I was just fortunate. I think sometimes timing's everything. And there was a lot of things that were undone in the mountains around here. And with the evolution of gear and everything, there was new possibilities for tons of things. So, and I had at the time I had the fitness drive and time to do it.
Well, yeah, let's touch on some of those things that you have achieved, I suppose. And it is quite a long list, and I have plucked a couple out. But in 2006, you set the world record by climbing 50,000 feet, which is over 15,000 meters for us in the metric system, in 24 hours. 4 years later, in 2010, you dedicated a year of your life to climbing and skiing 2 million feet. The challenge took you to four different countries and saw you climb, and correct me if I'm wrong, 114 kilometers and ski over 1,000 days. In March 2014, you climbed 100,000 vertical meters in the Canadian backcountry, which required 10 hours of skiing a day, up to 3,000 to 4,000 vertical meters. I'm interested to know, what was the driving force to accomplish these extraordinary feats of human-powered adventure?
I always kid that my brother makes the millions and I hike mine.
What's your brother do?
He was a .com success back in the day, and then Tree Hugger, a website, green website. And always done really well. But I think part of it was that it's like, you know, I've always wanted to achieve something with my life, and I didn't want to just be a ski bum, because I kind of felt like, yeah, well, that's great, but are you doing anything? And so I kind of started to quantify that I was doing something by latching onto those numbers. And, you know, for me, 50,000 feet was a really amazing day, because I'd spent probably 4 years working up to that number and just kind of visualizing it and training for it and just kind of trying to figure out how to do it. And, you know, I did, well, first year was 8,000, next year was 20,000, the next year was 30,000, the next year after that was 40,000, and then finally 50,000 feet. And so I'd basically been working my way up through those numbers, just trying to see what my own personal limits were. And it was amazing. I mean, it was great. It gave me something to train for, which is always really exciting. And then gave me these challenges that were, yeah, as hard as ever and as rewarding as possible. And then the 2 million feet, that was just kind of a nice number thing. In the year 2000, everybody was all worried about Y2K. And I was like, wow, imagine if you did 2 million feet in the year 2000. And then I didn't have any skills, fitness, knowledge at that point, but I spent the next 10 years kind of dreaming it up, not really speaking about it, but those 30, 40, 50,000 foot days. And then like a season where I did 88, 10,000 foot days, they were all kind of training for this eventual 2 million feet. So I knew I had the depth of energy and strength to pull off the 2 million feet. So, and then that year was sick. I mean, your numbers were kind of odd. It was 2 million feet. Was that 609 kilometers? And it was 77 different mountains and tons of first descents and adventures. And it was just like, it was the most incredible year ever. And I was, you know, it was made incredible because I had to get out there all the time and force some of the conditions, but also I got so lucky and got some great, great adventures. And then, yeah, took my watch over on Jan 30th that year. And it was definitely really, December 30th that year. And it was pretty, yeah, it was amazing to watch my watch tick over after having spent an entire year trying to work this little number up to 2 million feet. But yeah, it was just a way to quantify that I was working hard and really taking advantage of life. Cause I think life's this insanely magical, weird place, and you might as well follow your passions and do the most you can. Cause our time's brief.
We're obviously focusing on the numbers here for climbing, but yeah, the runs that you must've got there and the amount of.
Yeah, it was endless. The runs were crazy. And sometimes it was, you know, I did a lot of some runs a lot because they were the ones where I could be a dad and a husband and then go out in the morning early or the evening and get that 1700 meters that I needed on average per day. So
a lot of backcountry runs right there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the mountains are incredible and I just feel fortunate to be able to do them. And especially then I had so much strength and energy that I could really take advantage of the freedom out there.
So in that year, in 2010, where you got 2 million feet, you reference that in mm-hmm. the Curve of Time, one of your shows, and you say you wanted to get away from using helicopters like chairlifts. And a lot of pro skiers do kind of use, I guess, choppers and other various pieces of machinery to get access to certain areas. So you wanted to change your focus and of getting to the places rather than just the places themselves. So what motivated this change?
Yeah, I mean, I always knew, like, you know, at the time, like I was at an F-350, which is a big diesel truck, and a snowmobile, and I'd rip out into the mountains on my own lots, you know, drive that truck, whatever it is, 40 kilometers, park, drive the snowmobile 20 kilometers, park, and then go and just be in serenity in these incredible old growth forests and just enjoying nature and just being like, oh, this is the best. And then going and pulling up the cord on my snowmobile and it coughs black onto the snow. And then you drive back and that truck I had, it starts and it coughs black onto the snow. And I just knew I wasn't being like the best person towards the earth. And it was something that was giving me so much. And yet I was just being a total jerk. And yeah, I just knew it, you know, and it was great, especially as a pro skier. I was flying all around the world. I was also heli ski guiding. So my footprint was insane, right? The calculators didn't even work for all the different ways of killing the earth that I was doing.
I think I did find your blog site from back in the day, yeah. And you had put up a little photo of what your footprint looked like to the average American, I suppose, or North American. And yeah, mm-hmm. it was quite a lot bigger.
Oh, and like I say, that didn't have any of the snowmobiling or heli skiing because I don't even know he had put that in there. That had most of my flights because I was definitely flying around the world like crazy too. So yeah, and also I got, you know, I know I've always loved the environment. Then you've got kids and you start looking at them and you're like, well, what am I really doing? I'm just like, just not caring, being selfish and not caring about what happens next. And that's kind of felt a little bit shallow. But the truth is it actually takes a long time to finally commit because you have to sacrifice some things. And I wasn't ready. I went to Pakistan. I went on a crazy adventure there and I ended up almost dying in an avalanche, crazy, crazy adventures. And anyhow, while I was healing on this couch over here, I was kind of thinking that if I died right then, what would my legacy have been? Would, you know, what would the stories they've told about me? And I was like, well, pretty cool, you know, motivate people to push, dig deep and find their passions and like just giver and set goals for themselves. But then there was that, well, there was this total unselfish, like, or total selfish side that wasn't doing anything for the earth. And so while I was kind of healing then, I was like, okay, I got to start doing something. You know, it's you feel a little paralyzed at times when you look at the news these days and everything. And it was a little bit less then, but, you know, it kind of felt like this unsurmountable challenge. But I also felt like I should at least do something. So that's sort of the curve of time was like Chris is my first kind of attempts at changing how we adventure. And, you know, for me, the electric car is like, in BC, it's 98% hydroelectricity here, which is as green as electricity really gets.
Yeah.
Well, wind turbines are better. Anyhow, we're not going to talk about that, but it's like it's a decent form. The energy in BC is hydro, and it 98% hydro, and that really just makes it electric cars make sense because that means you're not using coal to create electricity that then you're driving your car. It's kind of felt like a great way to adventure if I could kind of prove to the world that electric cars worked and you could live a great life and have less impact. And so I kind of latched onto the electric car as like a vehicle for an idea of just trying to become a more sustainable adventurer.
That film we just touched on, The Curve of Time, it really documents a pretty unique ski mountaineering adventure with your friend there, Chris Rubens. So can you provide some more insight on that journey and what you're setting out to achieve?
It was hilarious. Because the electric cars weren't, you know, there was a couple of Teslas out there, but in 2017, there was not really any options for people of regular incomes. And I found a Nissan Leaf that went 160 kilometers in Vancouver, and we rented it, and we wanted to go down and ski as many volcanoes down to California as we could. That was the route.
Did you tell them that at the rental store? What your intention?
Well, it wasn't even a rental store. It was some guy that was renting the car out because he liked the ideas of. And
oh, awesome! Know. That's pretty good. Yeah.
I kind of told him, but I was a little vague. I didn't want him to know about logging roads and such. Yeah. He was excited because he knew we were trying to push the limits of what electric cars could do. But it was really neat because the infrastructure was just in place to go down the coast, the electric car infrastructure. Now it's amazing to see the difference. I watched it grow. But then it was like there were some gaps that were right around that 160-kilometer range. And just kind of doing all the math, we really took that car. We did, I can't remember, I think maybe 4,000 kilometers on that trip. I wish we'd counted the charging times because we charged a lot. But it was this idea. Yeah, we climbed six different volcanoes and skied them. And I kept looking in the parking lots and thinking like, it'd be so cool if this is the start of more and more people at least trying to adventure better. And then electric cars is like, it's a start. And if we, as the outdoor people are doing that, at least we can start pushing the needle. And it's pretty neat now because that was 2017 and Mount Shasta was the last volcano we skied. And I went and skied Mount Shasta this spring and looking around in the parking lot, it was cool. I saw quite a few electric cars, which was quite neat. I also saw a lot more cars because now way more people are into the outdoors than then. But it was just a neat idea to see that things had changed, shifted a bit in 6 years, and hopefully in another six, it's shifted way more.
Yeah, well, that's really. I was about to ask if you'd seen a change, and that's really rewarding to see that come from the other side there. And I guess some of the technology has improved since then, so access in potentially all-wheel drive vehicles that are powered by green energy are available these days over there. We're pretty behind it down here.
Oh yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, I wish I don't like debt, so I haven't tried to get a lease on a $100,000 vehicle. But yeah, there's tons of options. There's tons of cars now that are all wheel drive, and it's definitely growing. I mean, it's pretty neat. Now you can at least rent electric cars, which is really neat because a lot of people are still skeptical about them. And like Hertz, big rental company. When I went into LA this year, I rented an electric car. I rented a Tesla Y because I could, and it wasn't much more than a regular car. And all of a sudden, I was, if I was somebody that was new to electric cars, I'd be able to test out the idea and see how it works on a trip. And it was awesome. I mean, the Y is incredible because it actually flattens right down, and you can sleep in the back really comfortably.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
it even has a button that you put into camp mode, and you decide how warm you want the inside of the car to be, and it keeps it that temperature all night.
So it's designed for that.
Not quite, but from my perspective, absolutely.
Yeah. Now that'll appeal to a lot of dirtbag skiers for sure down here. So it'd be exciting to get that option for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Problem is the dirtbag and Tesla are two ends of a spectrum.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if they would correlate too well, but who knows?
But that is an idea. It's like a lot of this environmental stuff, it's intimidating. You kind of have to create these habits, and maybe you don't want to try one or you're too scared to buy a car. So that idea that you can actually rent an electric car allows you to at least test out that idea and see how it would work in your lifestyle. And then if it could become a habit, because like we'll talk a little bit later, I'm sure, but like habits, that's all we want to do with anything green. If we can turn it into a habit and then you just do it, you don't even notice it and you're being better. It's kind of neat.
Well, speaking of habits and, making the changes, you've made some changes since 2017 to your own lifestyle, and Electric Greg, another one of the films that Solomon TV has kind of made, you can see that. Could you maybe share some of the challenges that you've had to go through and what have some of the sacrifices been?
Yeah, well, like that carbon footprint calculation you were talking about that you saw, like right away, it kind of shows you the sort of the pillars or the sections of your life that you can attack. And, since then, I've tried things that worked and some that haven't, and it's kind of neat. And you can't really get too mad at yourself because you're trying. And if it doesn't work, well, that's okay. Try something else. We need to not let perfection get in the way of progress is something we all say in the environmental world. And none of us are going to be perfect, so let's all just be better, and that'll actually have way more impact. Right away, I have my brother Graham, who I mentioned briefly, he'd done a TED talk on weekday vegetarianism and how if you just ate meat on the weekends and took the weeks off, you'd have a huge impact on your footprint. And so right away in 2017, I started doing that after I did that carbon calculation. And that was kind of neat. I did quite well with it for about 4 years, and now it just kind of sways more to like half and half vegetarian. And the kids seem to like more meat than not. So I kind of I'm not as strict as I was, but for quite a few years, it was great. It was really just an easy way to make it. Okay, we're vegetarian Monday to Friday, and it's the weekend. Let's eat.
Yeah.
Big fry ups every weekend on the Barbie, especially to you Aussies. I mean, the Barbie's a very important part of your life.
That's right. Yes.
And then for me, I mean, one of the things is that I work with all these companies, you know, Salomon, Arc'teryx, Swinto, and Gore-Tex, and other companies, and I have to create stories. So I had to, that's my job, is to try to figure out how to continue working as a pro skier that I'd become and still move forward environmentally. It was pretty neat. It's kind of been a constant challenge because I realize that's all we are, as story creators. So if I can continue to create interesting stories around environmentalism or greener adventures, that was also very important. So it's just trying to find which sections you can actually change and work on them. And, you know, because I got the electric car, eventually I got interested in solar panels, and we don't live in the best place for solar panels in the winter, but since May, I've made more electricity than I've used. And that's been really neat. And it's not going to work well in January or December to March, but you just kind of keep trying different things. A couple of years ago during COVID, I created a COVID coop and built a chicken coop and chickens. I'm a big gardener. I haven't done well this year, but I typically garden quite a bit. I built this chicken coop, and for like 2 years we had chickens and eggs, and I just took care of them, and it was really neat. But I started realizing that my family doesn't actually eat that many eggs, and that it was stinky and noisy and disturbing the neighborhood for just me to have eggs. And I was the only one that was eating 5 eggs a week. So I kind of, sadly, I stopped that, but it was neat to explore something like that and see if it would work, and it didn't. But that's sort of what I feel with all these different actions you can do, is just kind of test them. And if they work, sweet, you got a new habit that's a little better for the world. Like, as simple as getting the chicken burger instead of the beef burger is actually less of an impact. Or, you know, there's all these options all the time. And if you just kind of try to figure out the ones that work for you.
I guess some of the other challenges that are depicted in that little adventure film there is like flights and getting around the world.
That's such a tough one, especially, well, we all live on different size islands. But I mean, for you guys, it's to go anywhere. You can want to take a flight and...
Mm.
Flights is a challenging one because it's actually not huge in terms of overall world impact. I think it's right 2-3% the aviation industry, but the problem is that's mostly us. So it's a huge impact, and it's tough not to, like, you know, you want to go to Hawaii with your family and show them the world, or like Charlie coming to Australia, you don't want to limit that, but you also want to be more conscientious about it, I guess. It's a real tough one for sure.
Yeah, it is, because, you know, a lot of, I guess, Australian skiers that are into the sport want to experience those powder days in Japan. Apart from kayaking, there's not many other options.
No, there's not, and that's the thing. And we can't get too down on it. And we have to push for different options. I mean, thinking now, like, there's a small company, coastal company, airline company, that he's developed an e-plane, and he's doing these short hour and a half flights on the BC coast, and he's doing them electrically, and that's kind of changing. And
oh wow, that's really,
I think, kind of, yeah, we just kind of got more demand and keep pushing, and the solutions are going to come. I mean, we're pretty technologically advanced.
I guess some of those solutions are helping people make the shift over to a more greener lifestyle, but I know so many people that are skeptical about making the changes due to the overwhelming challenge ahead of us. So what advice would you offer to people with that sort of mindset?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many cheesy quotes out there because they actually make sense. But like, we don't want 10 perfect people. We want millions of imperfect people. You know what I mean? Like, we just all need to do little things. And yeah, it's like, for sure, I go through these ups and downs. Like I said at the start, there's times when I just want to bury my head in the sand and do nothing. But I know that a lot of it is, it feels better. And you also find a community of people that care, especially just like one of the biggest things, just making it a conversation. And then, you know, and you can kind of influence everyone around you, and it just slowly grows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my biggest thing is that there's individual changes and there's policy changes, and obviously policy needs to change, but I don't think a government should be a reflection of its citizens. So if its citizens aren't willing to change, why would the government change, sort of thing? So yeah, I don't know. Like, the other thing to do is, so in that case, you know, it's like, for sure, the individual, it's tough. So let's policy change. So for me, it's been joining an environmental nonprofit that can add its voice to the movement. So there's a few in Canada, you know, we have Protect Our Winters, which is known throughout the world as for the snow and stuff. And, you know, at this point now, it's, I helped start it years ago. And now what it was, let's think about 7 years later, we're getting invited to the, to meet with the MPs and kind of help kind of push some policy changes. And it's just by becoming, adding more members, more people into that community gives the nonprofits a louder voice. You know, in Canada, we've got the David Suzuki Foundation, and just by being part of them, they send me emails every once in a while. They're like, hey, here's a letter that you can write to the person in the government that has to read it and understand that you care. And they set it up and make it easy. And then at least we can keep making noise. So eventually the government changes. For me, I felt like if I wanted to talk about environmental things, and if I wanted to help sway people's ideas, that example is the only way to influence others. I don't think there's nothing else. If you're not an example in doing it, then the rest is lip service and it doesn't count. So that's one of the reasons I've always liked the changes, is it adds weight to helping me convert others.
For sure. And your work and others around the world that are pushing really great messages about climate change, the message is definitely being heard. Like our last federal election, we had the most green voters ever, I think, and it definitely kind of changed our parliament. So it's exciting.
It's exciting, and it's huge. It's going to take a while, and for sure, it can be depressing. You watch the news. I mean, we had these insane fires this summer.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's scary. I was watching my province burn, and there's smoke outside, and I've lived here for 22 years, and I don't recall the first 15 years having smoke, and now the last like six have had smoke, and just seeing those changes, and it's scary. But I feel like for anxiety and anything, is action is the best thing. So if you start taking the actions, you'll empower yourself and your friends, and it'll just feel good because you're doing something. I mean, one of the things I do in my talks is I put up a picture of a grandfather with his grandchildren on his knees, and they've got gas masks on, and the kids are looking up at their grandfather, and they're like, "Granddad, what did you do during the climate war?" And I kind of put myself in that granddad's position. I think, well, what do you know? I want to at least make sure I'm doing the best I can.
Yeah, doing as much as you can. Yeah. Trying to make a difference. And as you say, those small differences do feel good. Like we've got chickens here ourselves in a veggie garden. I guess some people might ask why bother, you know, when you can just buy everything from the store or whatever. But
yeah,
these changes do feel good. And backcountry skiing is the same. Probably not going to get 1,000 runs in any single year, but you know, the couple of runs that I do get backcountry skiing, it feels honest and it feels clean, and it's good for the soul as well, I suppose.
Yeah. I guess what we didn't talk about is you kind of vote with your dollars too. Like everything we buy, we're saying we agree with whatever we're buying from. So, you know, when you're buying equipment, try to find companies that are being better, you know, and there's all sorts of different levels of that. And some companies do greenwash, but most are really trying to be better. And you just find the ones that align with your values. And, you know, that's kind of one of the things as an athlete is I've been pushing the companies I work with for years, and the changes are awesome. And I you know, we used to have business meetings. You'd never even talk about sustainability. And now every time we meet, there's at least an hour on sustainability and how we're changing the products and changing the transport and, you know, trying to just minimize the footprint of every piece of gear they're making. So when you buy whatever you buy from companies that you believe in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess an example would be like Patagonia, where they're committed to making their jackets out of recycled bottles and things like that. So, and I didn't know Arc'teryx, are they working in that space as well then?
Yeah. Their biggest thing is re-gear, where the gear comes back and gets fixed. And it's pretty awesome, actually. Yeah, it's just giving things a much longer life, because the longer a thing lives, the less its footprint is.
Yeah.
That is, there is always that line where it's like, well, shit, okay, excuse my language. Well, this stuff's made out of recycled bottles, but if it's poorly made and it doesn't last, then you're getting another one the year later. That doesn't work either. You know, yeah. There's definitely a line between craftsmanship and quality and green that needs to be found for sure. It's one of the reasons we don't all wear bark, because it doesn't work that well.
Yeah.
But it's very green.
It is very green. But yeah, it does make that commitment from those companies to create that change, I suppose, too, because they're the ones selling the gear. And it's great to see some initiatives like the gear return occurring. And I remember being in living in Canada for a year and a half, and Mountain Equipment Co-op had the best return policy I've ever seen, and they would fix things if they could. So that was really eye-opening for me, because I definitely hadn't seen anywhere like that in Australia. So
yeah. Oh, yeah. Like right now, like the Arc'teryx stores, quite often there's a side where there's sewing machines, all zippers and all the things that typically are easy fixes that are part of the store now.
Oh, that's so awesome. That yeah.
You can rock into your gear and all of a sudden gets things fixed, which is awesome, because why not?
Well, Greg, thanks so much for your time. And I guess my final question here is asking what's in the pipeline in the future. So can you provide any insight on some future projects?
Yeah. Well, there's a few for sure. 2 years ago, I spent a month on Mount Logan, Canada's highest mountain. And we spent 2 weeks on the summit plateau, and we drilled this ice core, this 330 meter deep ice core that has gone on for scientists to look at and kind of figure out climate change. And it was amazing, but I never actually stood on the summit of our highest mountain. And wow. So next year is the 100th year anniversary of the first ascent. Not next year, 2025 is the 100th year anniversary of the first ascent. And I'm kind of thinking I'd like to go there and try to climb it 100 years later and kind of finally stand on Canada's highest peak.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I think that's just something that's in the pipeline. But another thing, last year, so I've been skiing forever, and I've always had snowboard partners, slipboard partners for years, and loved watching them. And you know, over my life, I'd done like 10 days of snowboarding or something. But last year, I decided I was kind of feeling stagnant with my skiing. You know, I'm not getting any stronger, fitter, faster, that's for sure. And so I was feeling stagnant with my skiing, and I was like, okay, let's try something new. And I switched and splitboarded and snowboarded for most of the year. And it was incredible, because I had a whole new field where I could progress and learn and evolve, you know, and it was awesome. So that was super exciting. I kind of, my midlife crisis joke is that my splitboarding name is Shreggy. It's kind of an ulterior, younger, wilder, just kind of, you know, a snowboarder kind of guy. And it was really fun, like expressing Shreggy last year. And just the other day, I started realizing that I'm quite looking forward to starting my second year of snowboarding.
Wow.
Because now I've all of a sudden got a year of snowboarding behind me. It'll be really cool. Yeah, no, it's just really fun to take something new and to open my mind a bit. And it's like, you know, I all these lines that I'd skied before, I was snowboarding, and it was a totally, totally different thing when things that you'd never thought of was challenging were all of a sudden challenging. And it was great to be humbled and also to gain skill, and kind of, I did lots of wild things on it. It was fun.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, well.
But don't worry, I'm always going to be a skier. Don't worry. I'm not switching, but I really do. Snowboarding is pretty incredible.
Yeah, no, we often joke on the show about the rivalry between snowboarders and skiers, but yeah, we've got no issue with it. We just love backcountry skiing and backcountry boarding and whatever your craft.
Yeah, just being in the backcountry, exactly. Yeah, there's a guy last year, after 25 years of touring in Rogers Pass, I toured past somebody that was on a monoboard, split monoboard.
In the backcountry?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, it was sick. I wish I'd actually had time and I could have just joined them and seen it, because that's such a cool idea. I mean, why not?
Yeah, that's certainly interesting. I'm just trying to picture that in my mind right now.
And yeah, thanks for having me on your show. It's been great. Hopefully I didn't talk too long. And yeah, if there's ever any interest or about anything, it's easy to connect with me, and I'm always open to chat with people and kind of just help people along on their journeys.
Thanks so much, Greg, and really appreciate your time. So ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that brings us to the end of another great interview on Those Telly Guys. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Greg Hill as much as I did. It's pretty clear for me that his passion for skiing in the mountains is nothing short of inspiring. And I think one of the sticking points of the episode is to remember, as we all navigate our own adventures on and off the slopes, that it's essential to cherish and protect our breathtaking alpine landscapes. Because who knows, if the trend continues into the future, as it undoubtedly looks like it will, it's hard to say what our future of Australian skiing looks like over the next 100 years, but it's not looking great. So do what you can, hit the switch, strap on a pair of patent-based skis and get into the mountains on your own steam, and feel good that you're making those small changes that will inevitably, over time, inspire others to do the same. So until next time, keep those bindings tight, your tips up, of course, and we will see you in the next episode on Those Telly Guys. It's bye for now.
Those Telly Guys hope you have enjoyed this program. We'd love to hear from you. Please get in touch at thosetellyguys@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this show, please subscribe for more fun episodes. Otherwise, you can find us on Instagram. Thank you.